Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program Hank Spies and Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, where it's our monthly show on home maintenance. We've been doing these programs for a long time to give you the opportunity to call in and ask questions. Maybe there's some problem, something that has come up just here over the past couple of days or weeks. You're not quite sure what to deal with it, or there's some other kind of change you're thinking about making. You're thinking about doing some remodeling, any and all of that. Between the two of them, they know a lot about single-family homes and how they're put together and some of the problems that can occur. So if you have a question, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you got questions, you can give us a call. Thanks very much for being here.
Sure.
We appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Good to be back.
One thing I think that you would like to have a chance to talk about, and it may be on people's minds now because we have had recently had an occurrence here where we had widespread power outage where people were without power for a long time. People may be hearing about what's going out in the Northwest with that. And maybe people are thinking about, well, in what way should they prepare and what do they do if it comes to that point? And I think that you wanted to say some things particularly about using generators, things like that, that people probably most of the time they're not thinking about that. But at these times they think, well, what do I do with the power when it goes off? And if I want to have some supplementary power source, if there's no electricity, you know, how do I think about that?
Okay, well, first thing to remember, when you do have an auxiliary system such as a generator, you need to make sure it's properly connected. You have to make sure that before the generator power is applied to the house power, that you are disconnected from the power lines. While there may not be any power in the power lines, you want to make sure that you're not backfeeding your service panel to backfeed the wires so that some serviceman back there trying to put two wires back together doesn't get across your generator. Mm-hmm. Also, most generators are small enough that they're not going to run all the appliances in the house. So you want to try and make sure you turn off most of your breakers, particularly your high current draw items, and only use the things that you need at that particular point in time, because say a 4,000-watt generator really is not going to try and run your furnace, your well pump, and along with your two or three refrigerators and a freezer. It just doesn't have enough power. They all kick on at one time. You're going to kill your small generator. So you want to make sure you have the proper size generator for the items that you need to keep running.
Mm-hmm.
I do recommend keeping usually a refrigerator so that you can keep food from spoiling, usually a few lights and the furnace, but try and turn off all unnecessary items. If you've got an electric water heater, it's a good idea to have it on for short periods of time. Leave it on for an hour to heat up in the morning and then turn it back off. So it's not trying to keep the water hot the entire time when you're trying to use it for heat and the refrigerator. Also, well pumps you have to worry about, because if you're going to in a rural area with no city water, a well pump can draw a fair amount of current. So you have to kind of time these things. They do make some very specific generator switching systems, which can be used with either an automatic or a manual switch. The generator comes on, it automatically disconnects or manually disconnects from the service panel before applying the generator power, and only certain circuits are powered by the generator so that we're not overloading the generator, overloading the wiring.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like this is something that really, if you're going to have a generator, particularly if you're going to have something that's going to come on automatically, that you're going to have it installed by an electrician.
Absolutely.
Well, I can never say not to have it installed by an electrician, but when we do have emergency situations, here a couple weeks ago, Decatur had people without power for 10, 12 days. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're not going to call an electrician and say, come wire up my generator. So the thing to remember there is if you have to do an emergency situation where you've got a motor home with a generator, or you can borrow a generator and you can hook it up, make sure you disconnect your main circuit breaker before you attempt connecting power to anything in your house. That way you cannot backfeed the system. Also, it means that you can, while you're in there, turn off all the unnecessary breakers so mm-hmm. we're not trying to overload anything.
So if you make sure I understand this, so if you're going to have a generator and you have things plugged in directly to the generator, then you should also, at the point where the power comes into the house, you want to disconnect the house from the outside power line?
If you've got power in the house, whether you're plugged in direct to the generator or anything, make sure you have the main power disconnected, okay, just for safety. Yes, if you've only got two outlets on the generator and you're plugged in to a refrigerator and a furnace, what ends up is most people try and backfeed the system. They'll plug the generator into the house and backfeed the house through that system, and that's where it becomes a problem with backfeeding all the way back down the lines.
Okay.
So anytime there's an auxiliary power in the house, it really is recommended that you disconnect from the power company until you can disconnect your auxiliary power.
Okay. Anything else you want to add to that?
Well, we get into the auxiliary sources of heat. For instance, if your gas furnace isn't working and you want to use an electric heater someplace, be sure that electric heater is not running off an extension cord. It needs to be plugged in directly.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, we strongly advise against using the burners on your gas stove as a source for heat, primarily because of the possibilities of carbon monoxide and things like this coming. The same is true of the portable heaters, the kerosene-fired heaters, gas-fired portable heaters. When a few years ago, when Indianapolis area was out, they had something like 400 people being treated in the hospitals for carbon monoxide.
Mm-hmm.
And and somewhere along the line, we need to make more people aware of the fact that there is a new state law in Illinois beginning January 1st that requires a carbon monoxide alarm within 15 feet of any sleeping room. And this is true, you know, one on each level of the house as well. And this is even true if you have an electrically heated house and have no gas burning in it whatsoever. If there is an attached garage, you must have a carbon monoxide detector. Because in a number of cases, we've had people been killed by carbon monoxide in the house because of a car left running in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a brand new law effective January 1, rentals, owner-occupied, whatever. Mm-hmm. Everyone is required to have this carbon monoxide detector system.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we ought to underscore this because we were talking about this beforehand. We have one in our house, but we have one. We do have smoke alarms on every level of the house, in the basement, on the first floor, on the second floor.
Right.
But the recommendation is now that you would actually also have, in addition to having, you should have a smoke alarm on every floor. Now the requirement is that you have your carbon monoxide detector and also have one of those on every floor.
That's correct. And you must have them within 15 feet of any sleeping room. So this can reduce the chances significantly because apparently Seattle is having that problem at the moment. They're getting,
yeah,
a bunch of carbon monoxide cases out there. And as I say, we know we had this one in Indianapolis a few years back.
Hmm.
Well, it seems that most people, what they don't understand when they go to an auxiliary heater is read the instructions. Most of those auxiliary systems, whether they be propane-powered or kerosene-powered, do say on there to provide adequate ventilation. Most of them actually recommend opening a window when they're in operation and never, ever, ever use an unvented gas appliance in a sleeping room. Put it into a main room or something, but never in a sleeping room because of the chance of being overcome by the carbon monoxide while you're asleep.
Yeah.
Like I say, most of those, they say provide adequate ventilation, and they neglect to tell you in big print that that means open a window. That's all in the fine print at the back. And so everybody says, well, I'm not going to open a window. I'm going to freeze. Well, you need that oxygen, that extra, yeah, air and ventilation.
These are things that they were essentially made for use in a garage or a machine shed or something like that, where there, in fact, would be some ventilation. So it was never intended to be something that if your power went off and you had no heat that you would bring into the living room and put there in the middle of the living room.
Very true. And we have these unvented gas fireplaces these days. The instructions that come with them say that you should never operate them for more than 4 hours a day and that, again, you should have a window open and so on. The only way they are permitted under code, at least locally, is that they be classified as a decorative appliance, not as a heat source.
Okay.
And that's strictly it. If you want some flames to watch over in the corner, why, fine, it's a decorative appliance. Should never be considered main heat source.
Okay. Well, we got some callers here. Should we talk with some of these folks? And if people have questions about that or anything else, Hank Spiess, Scott Spiess, both of them here from the Spiess Home Inspection Service. We're talking about home maintenance. You have a question, you have a problem, give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller in line is in Danville on line four. Hello.
Good morning. One of the two things I wanted to ask about was generators, so I've been furiously making notes. One comment I want to make, I've had carbon monoxide detectors for years, but one of them in the bedroom is plugged in. So the battery-powered ones are the ones you want if you don't have electricity.
The one you have that's plugged in probably has a battery backup.
Oh, it does. Well, I know the one downstairs near the furnace is a battery. Okay, now about the generator, the other questions I wanted to ask, the automatic disconnect an electrician installed sounds ideal. What maintenance that might be in the scope of an elderly lady would be necessary for those?
Well, with a gas generator or a propane generator, like I say, usually the ones that are automatically switching are propane-powered rather than gasoline-powered so that you can hook them up to your rural propane tank type system if you're out in the country, or a 20-pound tank if you're in town.
You mean pretend like you've got a barbecue or something and use that sort of thing for it?
That is correct. They work a little bit more reliably than a gasoline. Don't run out of fuel quite as quickly. But you want to make sure that it runs once every year or so. You want to go out there and just check it, turn the system on, and make sure everything operates. But for the most part, they require very little actual maintenance.
Okay, so now I would be interested in you know, keeping the gas furnace maintained, which, of course, requires electricity. It's and then the other for a refrigerator. But now the generator would be in the basement. The refrigerator is upstairs. Do you run an extension cord to the refrigerator?
Okay. First of all, you would never operate the generator in the basement. It should be
that's where the furnace is.
You do not want to operate that generator anywhere inside the house. It should either be outside or it should be in the garage and vented to the outside. But it should never be actually in the house.
Oh, well, gee, I didn't know that.
Some of the automatic systems that I've been seeing at the local Rural King or Farm Fleet type stores actually have an enclosure that sits outside. The whole thing is a complete self-contained unit that mounts on a pad outside the house. Of course, the temporary ones usually you would store in your garage, then wheel outside or run an exhaust pipe outside so that when they're running that the exhaust is going outside the building. You never want to have that coming back in either the garage or into the house.
Oh, okay. Well, that puts a different complexion on it. Well, then now the next question is, when one does have electricity and so on, I've noticed several people and several ads for these little auxiliary heaters that will just heat one room in the evening. And I wonder if you would discuss the various ones. I've seen the ones that look like a little radiator that have oil, you know, going through, and then I've seen the baseboard type things. I keep my thermostat pretty low, but sometimes in the evening the room gets cool, and it's just necessary to heat one room, to read or something before retiring. What kind of auxiliary heater would you recommend for that situation?
Well, if you're going to use an electric heater, which is very good for individual room-type heating, if you're going to try and keep the rest of the house cooler.
Right, just an enclosed small room.
Yeah, electric heaters are 100% efficient. Any of the heat produced by the electricity stays in the house, so it really doesn't matter what type you have. The oil units usually are a little bit more comfortable in that they heat the oil and so that the radiator stays warm and not real hot. The ones with the exposed burners, of course, a blanket or something gets close to them. They can be a fire hazard, where the oil one is a little bit less prone to that.
Uh-huh.
But again, make sure that since it is an electric heating appliance, it is a fairly high current draw item. You do not want to have it on an extension cord. You don't want to have the cord running underneath a carpet or anything that would insulate it or where it could be damaged.
That can be plugged in directly to the wall.
It would have to definitely be plugged in directly into the wall. But like say, with electric heat, it's 100% effective. All the heat produced stays in the house. So it really, the type of heater would more go with your decor. Of course, it is a nice idea to have one that has a tip over switch. So if it falls over, it gets bumped, it does shut itself off. And most of them
And then I've seen ads for conductive where it heats people, not furniture. Now,
These are radiant heat sources. And basically, it's a matter of the fact that you are a radiator. In other words, your body radiates heat to any surrounding surface that is colder than it is. So this may make you feel cold, but basically we have units that go in the floor or the ceiling or whatever that tend to heat the mass of the building rather than heating the air. And as long as you keep the surfaces around you warm, you will feel warm because they are radiating heat to you. So
the more efficient of this type, as far as being comfortable and yet not, using more power than you need, would be?
Basically, a radiant heater that is using essentially to heat you and to heat the rooms, not the air. You're heating the mass of the room and the room surfaces rather than heating the air.
I see. Well, thank you for your information.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll go on here next to Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I don't have a life-threatening issue or anything like that. I have a rodent problem. I'm getting mice in my wall between my kitchen and my sitting room, and I'm just wondering if you have any handy tips for looking for where the critters are getting in, or if even those electric you can plug them in, and they supposedly send out sonic waves and chase the mice away. I was wondering if you had any hints for me.
Well, I don't think these sonic repellers work very well. That's been our experience on them.
That would be too easy.
Yes. Otherwise, you have to realize that a mouse can get through a hole of a little less than a half an inch.
Uh-huh.
So it's a matter of any possible source where they can get in, stuff them with steel wool or something like that that the mouse can't chew through. And then there are the various and sundry mouse poisons that make them head for water and therefore die outside the house rather than in it.
Oh, so you can get them to ingest something that will take them out of the house?
Yes.
Oh, good, because we have them actually dying in the wall occasionally, and that's not pleasant at all.
No, not at all. Decon is probably the most generally available and one, but if they eat into that, they will go out and head for water.
Okay,
and that's as good as anything else.
Thank you very much.
All right, Scott, did you want to add anything on?
Well, with the bait systems, yes, it does tend to dehydrate them, and there is never any guarantee that they're not going to die inside the house. But as a general rule, it does tend to send them out. Depending on where you're at in the city or out in the country as to how many mice you're going to get. If you're out near a bunch of cornfields or a brand new subdivision that just got built, you're going to have some mice. So either a poison outside or a poison inside and sealing up. If you want to go down in the crawl space and look for light sources, that's a good way to find any holes through the foundation, around gas lines, around air conditioning lines, things like that. Crawl space, nice and dark. You stick your head down there. The only light that should be coming in is around your crawl space vents. And this time of year, you ought to have those pretty well closed off.
Yeah. All right. Well, very good. Let's go to somebody else. It's also a Champagne listener here in line number two.
Good morning.
Yes.
Here's the situation. I have an uninsulated detached garage, probably red cedar siding on it. Paint jobs do not last on it. It peels, it patches off. Would staining the inside of the board or painting it, sealing it that way help?
Yes, I think it would. Probably you're bringing moisture in the wintertime. The snow drops off your car and things like this, so we're getting moisture moving out. And I don't know how watertight your
it's not.
Slab is and all this kind of thing.
I mean, there's a lot of outside air that will come through gaps around the sliding door.
Yeah. But I would say definitely sealing the wood on the inside with paint would probably do it. Stain is not as waterproof as paint, so painting the inside would help.
Great. Thanks for your advice.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to line three next. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about a sump pump. Our sump pump pretty much runs very frequently, and I was thinking about getting some kind of a backup, but people have told me the batteries and the battery backup pumps don't last very long, and it's not worth doing.
Okay, well, the battery in a battery-powered sump pump will have to be replaced about every 2 or 3 years, whether you use it or not. You are in the city with city water?
Uh-huh.
Okay, there is a water-powered backup that works off the city water pressure. And I've lived here for almost 40 years, and only once have we had city water pressure fail for more than an hour or two. And they cost a little less than the battery systems, and are generally speaking a lot more reliable because they have no moving parts. They use the city water to provide a jet pump action and seem to work pretty well. Now, you will use about a gallon of water from the city for every gallon of water that you pump out, but generally speaking, if we have a power failure situation, that's not a major concern.
And this would be something a plumber could put in?
Yes.
And does it need electricity to run?
No, it does not. It runs strictly off city water pressure.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I mean, that means that it runs off water pressure all the time or only if there's no electricity?
Only you set it with the float higher than the one for your regular sump pump, so that as long as your regular sump pump works, this one will not do anything. If the pump fails or is inadequate at some point and water in the sump rises higher, then it will kick in the water-powered pump.
Okay, so we're talking about now actually having two, having the one, the regular one that runs on electricity. So as long as there's electricity, that one goes.
Right.
If the electricity goes off, you have a second one so that you will continue to have a pump working.
Right.
Okay.
Or if your primary pump were to fail, an electrical pump occasionally will wear out, so it would work as a battery backup system. It's basically a siphon system, like you'd use your garden hose to apply pesticides to a tree or something. It siphons the water out as the water goes past. So it does use about a gallon and a half or so of water for every gallon of water that it does draw out. So your water bill is going to see a slight increase, but at least you shouldn't have to worry about
having
a claim with flood insurance basement, for your basement.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Okay. How many years would you expect to get out of a sump pump? Is it something that
it depends on how much it runs.
Mm-hmm.
I have a house nearby where I live where I think they wear one out every 2 to 3 years because the thing never shuts off. And otherwise, you probably get 10, 15 years out of them.
Okay.
And the one point I'd like to make is if you've got a sump pump that runs a lot, rather than worrying about pumping it out, where's the water coming from? Is there a way of working with the drainage around the outside of the house? Is it surface water from downspouts that aren't being extended away or downspouts going to tiles that are broken? Usually a sump pump is pumping water that is collecting from your yard. Very rarely is it trying to pump an underground artesian spring out away from underneath the house. So if you've got a pump that runs a lot, you need to really pay attention. Okay, do I really want to worry about how to pump it out, or do I want to worry about how to keep it from getting to the pump so I don't have to pump it out?
All right. Very good. Well, we're at midpoint already here with Hank and Scott Spies, and we're taking your questions on home maintenance. One or the other of them is here on a regular basis, and we talk about home care. So if you got a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next up, Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I have an older home with still some knob and tube wiring in it. I'm considering having insulation blown into some of the spaces where the wiring is. According to some joker on television, you should not do that. According to the people that blow the insulation, they say they've done thousands. They didn't say how many houses burned down, but they don't think it's a problem. What's your opinion?
Well, I don't think knob and tube wiring is a problem if it is properly fused.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, the old knob and tube wiring was number 14, which means it should never have anything higher than a 15-amp fuse or breaker on it.
Right.
I know that they do not recommend insulating over wires in attics, for instance, because the rating of the wire is dependent on its ability to dissipate heat, and when you insulate it, you've just killed that off.
Yeah.
But again, as long as it is properly fused, I don't really see any major problem. I won't say we'll meet code, but generally speaking, we've looked at an awful lot of old houses, and I've even found them where the wires had gotten hot enough that they were no longer insulated. The insulation had burned off. But we tore the house down. It did not burn down.
Yeah.
You have to remember that on knob and tube, the wires are several inches apart, not an eighth of an inch like they are in a cable.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Just to go back to something you mentioned before, when you were talking about the fact that if you're using a space heater, an approved space heater, the kind that's made to be used indoors,
mm-hmm.
Either the kind that has white glow wires that glow, you know, or the kind that circulates the hot oil. One of the things you said was no extension cords. Is that because the extension cord actually gets hot and it becomes a fire hazard?
It can.
Okay.
It can, because most extension cords are not sized to carry that much load without overheating.
Okay.
And, of course, with an extension cord, you have more connections. Every time we have a plug, we have a chance of having a loose connection or a poor connection because we're trying to put multiple things together. So when you have a plug on an extension cord into the outlet, then you've got a plug from the heater into the extension cord. You've got twice as many areas where we could have a heat source or heat buildup.
Okay. If you have lamps, lights, standard household lighting on an extension cord, is that a problem?
Not usually, because generally speaking, we're only running 150 to 200 watts at a maximum, whereas the heaters are running 1,200 watts.
Okay.
The same way we don't recommend the ladies run a hairdryer on an extension cord.
Okay. Well, see, I guess that's right. Anything that makes heat or cold, those devices, they draw a lot of power.
That's right.
All right. So no extension cord. All right. Let's go to Champaign, line one next. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering about on an older house, the issue of maybe hydrostatic water maybe seeping in. I mean, this would be a basement that 99% of the time is dry, and you know, the gutters are extended out pretty far. I don't think there's any water running down by the foundation, but just if it rains really hard, occasionally maybe get a little bit of water seepage through the basement walls, and I think it's from just hydrostatic pressure. And I was just wondering if there's a way maybe I should just paint the basement walls there with some kind of coating to help with that, or just not even worry about it since it's so rare.
Okay, well, if it was truly hydrostatic pressure, it'd be coming up from underground. Basically, water would be being forced upward. It'd come through cracks in the floors. If you had a sump pump where you had a hole in the basement floor, that would fill up first because, of course, water will seek the lowest spot first. If it's coming through the walls, it's generally not hydrostatic pressure. If it's coming through the walls, it's generally surface drainage or saturation of the soil. Now, I will have to admit, the soil levels that we – or soil types that we have in Champaign County have a lot of clay to them and even have clay layers. You can have a perched water table where there's a layer of clay and the water soaks down to that clay layer or clay lens and then kind of moves laterally. And if your basement happens to drop below one of those clay layers, water from half the neighborhood can actually drain towards your basement. So if it's coming through the walls, it is usually an exterior problem. The paints and such that you put on the walls are fine as far as sealing the walls, but then the wall ends up filling full of water. Actually, Hank has a rental property where we were able to prove this. It's got a basement, and the basement flooded due to the water in the street being 12 inches above the curb. And water was actually just pouring through onto the cracks in the wall. And I went to the far side of the basement and broke a hole in the concrete block next to the sump pump. And 24 feet on the other side of the room, the wall quit leaking because it now had a way of getting out. So when you paint them and seal the inside of that, if you've got a block wall or a clay tile wall or something like that, you're just basically filling that wall full of water. So Yes, it might help a little bit with water seepage, but still the problem is water to the wall. Now, there are several baseboard drain systems that can be installed where they actually put a plastic baseboard epoxy to the floor, spaced slightly out from the wall, and then drill some holes in the block, and it actually lets that water drain out of the block, get behind that plastic baseboard, and then they pipe the baseboard over to the sump pump and collect it that way so it's not coming through the walls and other places. But it's still basically groundwater. Or surface water, rather, surface drainage next to the house. So the downspout extensions and drainage around the outside. I won't say that cures 100%, but that does get most of it.
Well, no, thanks. That answer, I appreciate it.
All right, very good. Let's go to Eureka next. This is another caller, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'm interested in two questions. First of all, the new carbon monoxide detector law that's supposed to go into effect January 1, 2007, does that apply to all houses, even or rental properties, even if they have electrical heat, or if they don't have, if they just have electrical heat, are you off the hook?
As long as you don't have an attached garage, you're off the hook.
That's the defining thing. No attached garage, then you don't have to put one in. If you have electric heating, I understand you correctly, sir.
Yes, if you don't, if you have no combustion, no gas rings, no electric, anything but an electric heating system.
If you have all electric, then you're all right.
Right.
With no attached garage. Secondly, if you have a space heater plugged into a surge protector, is that not recommended?
Well, a space heater on a surge protector, the surge protector is really not designed to handle high current items. Most surge protectors are for protecting delicate electronic items.
Uh-huh.
Chances are you're going to overload the surge protector if it actually does kick on. I don't know that the surge protector is designed to handle the high current.
Had one, and it kicks off a couple times, and if I put it on a little bit lower, it's working, but you're still saying it's not recommended.
Well, it depends. We now have whole house surge protectors, and of course, they're useful for everything.
Uh-huh.
But most of the surge protectors that you buy over the counter do not have enough capacity for that.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Very good. Thank you. And we'll continue. The next caller would be in Urbana, line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is about a deck that I had replaced in January, and they replaced the old one with pressure-treated wood, and I always was thinking I was going to get the proper sort of sealer or oil or whatever finish you're supposed to have and put it on the pressure-treated wood, but I never got around to it. And at this point, I'm wondering if you really need it, and if you do, what do you need?
Well, you don't really have to. It's not going to rot. Most people stain them or whatever for color maintenance rather than preserving the wood. But no, the wood is not going to rot if you don't put anything on it.
Oh, it's going to be okay. Huh?
Yeah.
So I don't need to do that.
Right.
And
it will weather gray and so on. And it depends on how sensitive you are to the color of the deck.
I see. Well, if I did put something on there, what would it be? What would you call it, or what would the name be?
You'd be using an exterior stain. Do not ever paint a deck.
Okay. Exterior stain. Is there any brand that you can recommend, or can you do that over the phone?
Well, I don't have my computer in front of me that lists the various ones that seem to work best, but if you will send me a stamped self-addressed envelope, I'll be happy to mail one off to you.
Okay. A list of all of them or just the best one?
The best ones.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Just also, over time, people have asked questions about various kinds of waterproofing treatments that are available for wood decks. And I think that Hank said that you like the idea of something that will give it some water resistance, but you don't want to actually seal it. Is that
right? We want it to be able to breathe because you're not going to keep all the water out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if we get some water in, we have to be able to get out as well.
So they do make some clear water repellents. Deck sealers and such, and a lot of that is they have a lot of UV protection, help to reduce sunlight deterioration, the cracking, drying, checking, graying of the deck. So a lot of the clear units are clear type repellents, not only help repel the water or bead the water up, mm-hmm. but also help preserve the color, the natural wood look of the deck rather than let it turn to the old gray, crack, check, peeling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you were going to look for one of these things, what kind of language, what kind of description of the product would you say people should be looking for?
I'd look for a water repellent rather than a sealant.
Okay.
So a repellent or a stain would work well.
All right. We'll go on here. And unless you – did you want to – I jumped in on you, Hank. I don't know if you were going to add on
something. No,
that's fine. All right. Then we'll go to Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I am thinking about adding a attached garage to my house, two-story. I'm wondering what type of problems I would run into as far as building codes off the property line. If you could tell me anything about that.
Well, that varies on your subdivision. The different subdivisions have different requirements for setback. You certainly do have city codes that would apply. If you're within a city, you'll have to get a permit and see that your construction meets their codes. The biggest problem is flashing it to the existing house so that you don't get any leakage where to join.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. We got a question here, an off-the-air question about radon that someone was calling in with, and I hope that there's enough information here I can actually give you what the person had to say. But here we go. Your listener did a home radon test. They did a six-month test. They got a reading of 4, and they did 12 months and a reading of 6. So they want to know if that's something that they should be concerned about and should they be trying to correct it. And also they say that they have a house that has a full basement and that the test was done in the living area. So I'm assuming that instead of putting the radon detector in the basement, they put it on the first floor.
Yes, and that's exactly what they should have done.
All right, that is what they should have done. Good. Okay. So is it? And I'm assuming that's picocuries. That's what we're talking about, the 4 and the 6?
Yes. Now, the EPA has designated the level of 4 as becoming the level of concern for the United States. In Canada, the level of concern is 20. There is some suspicion that the level 4 was picked because there would be enough houses in violation to justify the EPA's budget. if you can believe things like that happen. I personally don't get very excited as long as it's under 20. And in Champaign-Urbana, I have only seen one house that went over 20. Now, that is not true in Danville or Mahomet. It all depends upon what the underlying rock structure is. And the one that went high in Champaign was one where they had imported 2 truckloads of crushed rock from Mahomet to serve as a heat sink for a solar collector, and they brought the radon with it. The highest reading I've ever heard of in Illinois was in about 67. There are areas of the country, in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, readings of 200 are not uncommon, and those are very serious. We need to do something about that. There's one very small area on the Minnesota-North Dakota border where we hit 400. And so it is a problem of decomposition of rock, but certainly as long as the living areas are checking out, I certainly wouldn't do anything about a 6. And the radon level will vary with barometric pressure. When you have a high-pressure system, the radon level will be low because it's a gas in the soil. High pressure, the gas doesn't come out of the soil. You get a low pressure, more gas comes out of the soil, and you will get a higher reading. So that's why I was delighted to hear them say that they did a 6-month test rather than a two or three-day test, because those can be very misleading. And you definitely want to use it in the occupied area, no basements, no unless you're living in the basement.
Yeah, okay.
Certainly never check it in a crawl space. If you have a sump pump, the sump is often the major source because we have this perimeter tile around the outside of the house that comes to the sump. And generally speaking, if we use a sheet of plastic and seal the top of the pump, that can make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say for our caller in this particular case where they've got a level of 4 to 6, technically the 4 is the level of concern. If you're in the house and you don't leave on a regular basis or don't open the windows, Yes, I would start looking for, okay, where's the radon coming in? Cracks in the basement you could seal up, as Hank just indicated. Sealing the sump pump would probably be a big one, putting a sealed cover, and there are several different types of covers that are available for your sump pump that have a rubber gasket for the lines and such. And that would probably get your system, your house down far enough to where you don't need to put in a full-blown ventilated system. If you do that and you still end up with a radon level that's a little high, then yes, you need to install a system, particularly if you're somebody who doesn't leave the house on a regular basis, which is what they base their level concern on, is how often you're in the house, how many hours a day versus how many days a year, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, and that four number does have some parameters as to how effective it is. And if you're in and out of the house, then it can make a big difference.
Okay. All right. I think that's based on 18 hours a day, 365 days a year.
Okay. And the main way of dealing with this problem is, in a sense, essentially constructing a kind of a ventilation system around the perimeter of the house that draws that air then and pulls it out and vents it up, I think, actually right. at roof
Yeah, you normally run
level.
Through the roof.
So that then it dissipates it, and rather than it coming up inside the house, what you're doing is you're sucking it up and you're getting it away so that it actually doesn't come into the house.
Right. At the moment, the only people that seem to be seriously concerned about it are lawyers or relocation companies.
All right. Well, what's in round figures, what's the cost? If someone decided they wanted to do, you know, what's the cost of one of these abatement kind of ventilation systems?
Probably system? About $1,200.
Actually, I think it's a little bit higher than that. But yeah, the fan or unit itself is relatively inexpensive, so it's more of a labor intensive. How much do we have to seal up? Do we have to put down a sheet of plastic over a crawl space? How do we have a sump pump and a sewage ejection pump? A lot of it's labor intensive. How easy is it to run the pipe up and out through the house? And, you know, if you don't mind having up the outside, it's going to be a little bit less expensive. If you really don't like the looks of it and want to make them run it inside the existing chimney chase or something like that, it could be a little bit more labor intensive. So I would say $1,200 to be on the low end. If you're trying to really seal up a crawl space area, you may end up in the $2,000, $2,200 range, something like that.
Okay.
Right. And you should be aware that you're going to have to replace the fan about every 10 years.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this Barn of Focus 580 with Hank and Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. So we're taking your questions on home maintenance, something we do every month here on the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Next, we'll talk with someone in McLean County and on line two. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, fine.
All right. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reviewing the policy about the carbon monoxide detector, because I've heard things, and I am not sure whether it's for all homes in Illinois, whether it's just rental property.
No, it is for all homes in Illinois.
Okay.
Owner-occupied or rental.
Okay.
And the requirement is that there be a carbon monoxide detector on each floor if there are any sleeping rooms in the house.
Okay.
And there should be one within 15 feet of the door of any sleeping room.
Okay, 15 feet. And how about in terms of, not necessarily brand names, but is there any way what kind of recommendation you might give to what to buy?
No, there are a number of them on the market. Generally speaking, they're in the $25 to $30 range. They do sell special 9-volt batteries for these things that instead of having to change them every year, they should last 7 to 10 years on the battery. Mm-hmm. The battery's going to be about $6, but you put that in. And on all new construction, the alarms have to be wired into the house power system rather than have a battery backup so that we always have power to them.
Okay. And you haven't run into any that are not worth buying then? You're saying just about any particular brand I can pick up?
No, I don't have a particular brand recommendation.
Okay. Well, no, I'm thinking any particular you have heard you shouldn't buy, you know, just in terms of...
No, I don't have anything. There hasn't been that much... not many of them out there at this point that we have any record of consistent problems. But generally speaking, they're monitored pretty closely.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks. It is also possible now, I know because I've looked at them, to get one device that is a smoke detector and carbon monoxide detector.
Yes.
So if you're going to – if that way, then instead of having two of these things on every floor, then you could fix it so you only have one.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you have a combination unit.
Yeah. All right. Do you like the ones that are plugged into the wall? Or does or we just say, well, it just you know, whatever you want to do.
On new construction, you don't have a choice. You have to have ones that are connected.
That are wired into the house.
Wired in. And as a matter of fact, they on new construction, they have to all be wired together so that if any one of them goes off, they all go off.
Okay.
So designed to wake the dead.
Yeah, I know. We bought one, and it's definitely loud. It's I think it's louder than the smoke detectors that we
have. Possibly.
It's pretty loud. No, I wouldn't sleep through it. Next caller here is, I believe, in Farmer City, line four. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a back patio that's got a drain spout going down next to the yard, and what happened was is my tile separated from the downspout. It goes out to the road, the drain, and what happened, that drain tile slipped down or something, and I think it warped a little hole out underneath my concrete. Now it's got a crack across the concrete, and then it seems to be seeping a little, or falling down a little bit. Should I have somebody come out to drill a hole in that and see what that's like underneath that?
Well, that's one of those things that there's always some settlement next to the foundation. So my guess is the downspout probably accelerated the settlement there when they dug the foundation and they backfilled with loose dirt and then put your concrete patio back over it. And then when it got wet, that soil settled. So there probably is a slight air gap. And only in really extreme cases is it enough that we really have to worry about it. As long as you keep the water away from it, you can get your downspout out of the way now, then you should be all right. Actually, the common way of filling that particular gap underneath a concrete patio is called mud jacking, and they do come out and they drill a hole or two underneath there and pump a hydraulic mixture of concrete and water down there. And that can be done, but usually is not necessary as long as you don't have water directly under that deck or under that patio.
The water seems to like this little bitty shower we had now just out there just a minute ago, and the water is still sitting there. Of course, it's seeped down enough that water will stand there a little bit now. So it is definitely lower in that one spot.
Well, then you want to do some regrading or some extension on that downspout to make sure that that water doesn't pool or pond next to the house.
I've corrected that, but just naturally water on the patio runs to that spot, I think.
Well, once the patio slopes are back. Yeah.
Right.
Backfill settles, and you can get it running back against the foundation. Yeah. And that would be cured by the mud jacking.
Yeah.
Kind of depends. Is it a basement or crawl space?
No, that's next to a sunroom, like a 20 by 14 sunroom, and it's on the outside of the house. No, there's no basement underneath this, but over long, about 8 foot back, I've got a tile at the basement floor where the water, if it did get in there, it would go down there and drain out.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it very much.
Yeah, okay. Another question I got. I got a shingles roof, and it's going to need to be replaced in the next 3 to 4 years. Have you ever heard of the blow-on insulation onto that? Onto a shake shingle roof?
You blowing it out of the bottom or the top?
They just spray it over the top. I had a fellow that my son built a new house, and the people that sprayed that in, they said they'd done a house up on 47. Excuse me. And I've never went up there to look at it yet. But they just spray it right over the shake shingles you have on your roof.
And that becomes the water shedding membrane. I've not had any experience with that.
Then you can't put you got to take the shake shingles off to put a tin roof on, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Is there people putting more tin roofs on homes now?
Somewhat, yeah. Most people don't like them because of both the noise and the appearance.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, thank you very much. Enjoy your show very much.
Thank you. Let's go at least one more back here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about an infrared space heater. Are there any health concerns?
No.
With such a heater?
No.
All right. Well, that's a good answer. Thank you.
All right. We'll go to Hersher then next. This is, believe, line number three. Hello.
Hello. I had a question for Mr. Spees regarding detection of a leak
in an in-floor heat system. I know he, I've heard him talk about using an infrared scope and shutting down the system and then starting it back up. And I was wondering if he could fill me in on the details of that again.
Well, basically, if the system is shut down so things cool down and use an infrared surface temperature system and look for warm spots when you start it up, it will show, generally speaking, I've been fairly effective in doing this. Rarely have I missed the leak by more than about 8 to 10 inches.
Okay. How long would the system actually shut down?
Oh, probably a few hours. Basically, what we're wanting to do is make sure that floor has a chance to cool off a little bit, and then so we can start pumping hot water into it, we can find the hot spots.
Okay, and what would that be, within the first half hour or so you should be able to detect that?
Oh, no, I would probably leave it off for 2 or 3 hours.
Okay, and then how soon after startup where you start using the scope?
Within, say, 15 minutes or so.
Okay, very good, thank you.
All right, thank you. One more, we'll go here to Indiana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I've got to put in a couple of posts, and I don't want to replace them too awful quick. So Lumberyard said pre-treated lumber is what they use, and they can't get creosote anymore, I'm told. So I'm wondering if there's anything I could do to those to the underground part of those posts to make them last any longer. How about paint?
Well, it won't be paint because paint won't stick to the pressure treated very well.
Okay.
So generally speaking, if they've pressure treated them properly, they should be good for 20 to 30 years.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I think that there, for this time around, we'll leave it with the promise that somebody, one of these guys, will be back here next month, I think, to continue to do the show. Hank Spies, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We've been doing these shows each month for a long time with Hank for a long time, and not such a long time with Scott, but we want to continue the service. So we'll see what we can do about having somebody show up here to do the show. Thank you both very much.
All right, thank you.
Great,
David.
Thank you. We've enjoyed it.